Good evening. When I was young, my favorite program, this might surprise some of you, my favorite program when I was little was a program on PBS called The Frugal Gourmet. And if you remember that show, if you've ever seen it, that man reminded me of a wizard. And I don't just mean because he was elderly and he had that white beard and the white eyebrows, the big bushy ones. And he was like, he embodied what a wizard was supposed to look like, you know, in fantasy. But I thought he was a wizard in the kitchen. I mean, he would take the most random things and the most simple of items, and he would whip up something that just looked so incredibly good. So much so that for a long time I thought the word frugal meant masterful or talented or impressive. And in a way it does, but not really. The word frugal really means maximizing the usefulness of resources. And really it's a word that could be transposed or used also for wisdom. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a synonym for making wise choices, at least as far as your budget is concerned. And the interesting thing about him in particular is he made this real big issue, even before it was popular, of going to, you know, the farmers' markets and going to the produce section and pointing out these things are in season and these things are going to save you the most money because this is why this works. You know, this is why this is less expensive, and because the farmers brought it all in at the same time, so there's going to be a bigger markdown on it. It's going to be less expensive. So you want to use that, right? And you want to use the things in your that are already available to you, and you want to use the cuts of meat that make the most sense to not only your pocketbook, but also to the meal you're making. I mean, all this wisdom that he was imparting to me, and I didn't even know what he was doing. Genius man. But what he also said was that it's not just about individual aspects. It's not just about saving money here and there. The entire meal, if you're going to be frugal, needs to be considered. That is to say, you can't put caviar in macaroni and cheese and say you're being frugal. That's not how it works. And that's the decision a lot of people make. They don't make wise decisions. They don't use wisdom in everything that they do. In fact, they limit it to specific things that they find important. But if we go back to Genesis chapter 47, a few things have taken place now. An amazing section there from chapter 45 and 46, when Jacob finally gets into the land of Egypt and meets Joseph for the first time in potentially decades. He hasn't seen his dad in years, and he sees his dad and he falls on him. I mean, he's an old man, guy. Come on, what are you doing? But he just can't do anything but just hug him. And it's just such a beautiful presentation of the relationship that those two had, at least a long time ago, the love that he shares. And then in 46, we see him taking his brothers and ultimately his father before the Pharaoh. I mean, how high of an honor is that? Incredible. And telling them, and inevitably getting his brothers a job in the kingdom to be shepherds, to become the royal and official shepherds of the king's flocks. Now that's going to be a significant thing here in just a few minutes. At the time, the Pharaoh doesn't have a whole lot of flocks. He is the ruler of the area, but people own their own land, it seems. They own their own place in the world, and they basically only pay taxes, which is a huge deal, but isn't as big as if he maybe owned all the land and all of the produce and all of the things that were going on, which we'll see in just a few moments. But what we're going to see here in Genesis chapter 47 especially is that Joseph shows frugality, right? He shows an ability to be frugal with the Pharaoh's resources. We already noticed the dream that Pharaoh has concerning the times of plenty, the 7 years of feasting and the 7 years of famine that would follow. So he's being prepared and he's storing all this grain and he's doing all the things that he needs to do as a leader in Egypt in order to procure the best chances of Egypt's survival. And because Egypt survives, so also his family survives. And so here in chapter 47, as we're going to begin in verse 13, he says, "Now there was no bread in all the land." It's been a year into the famine. "There was no bread in the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house." Now, we're going to stop there in verse 14. So it's not just the languidness of the land and the issues that you have of there not being any bread, but what inevitably happens when there is an issue of food? A lot of bad things start happening. People do things they wouldn't normally do. They feel desperate. And so what Joseph does first is he exchanges bread for money. That's the first thing that happens. They didn't have, it doesn't seem, at least historically, a currency like we do, like dollars or euros or pounds or whatever the economic image is in the area. But it seems like he was talking here about either gold and precious gems, right? Some kind of a commerce that could be created on actual possessions instead of trading and bartering goods and services. Like you come and you bring your cow and you say, I want this many bushels of wheat for this cow that I have, right? That doesn't facilitate trade. It allows trade, but it doesn't make it easy. And so the word money here, it seems, are useful commodities that would be easily traded back and forth. And that's the first thing that always goes. And notice what he does with this money. As they're trading Pharaoh, because Pharaoh is prepared for this famine, notice as he trades for Pharaoh, and he trades money for grain or bread, he trades it, and then in verse 14 he says, he doesn't just leave it wherever it is. He doesn't leave it out with the tax collectors. He doesn't leave it out there in the marketplaces when it's being traded. He brings it to a specific location, in a sense, probably even removing the temptation of individuals to rob the place. He brings it all the way into Pharaoh's own house, he says. The most secure location probably in all of the kingdom. In verse 15, notice he goes on. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed. He says, we don't have any more. That's what failed means in this context. He says, we don't have any more. We're out of money. What are we going to do? We shouldn't just die simply because we ran out of money. We have other resources. He says, then Joseph said, give your livestock and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone. Verse 17, so they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses and the flocks, the cattle of the herds, and for the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. So in one year, they're out of money. The next year, in order to get bread, grain, to make bread in that sense, it's a metonymy, it means the smaller thing for a larger thing, he gives out grain, not only for money in the first year, but now for the animals. Now remember, who is now the royal and official herdsman? His family. Interesting that that ends up taking place, and his family is in a position of prosperity, not only, as we mentioned last week, in the location that is probably the greatest area of Egypt in the land of Goshen, considered one of the greatest places to live, one of the most fertile areas, but now they are the herdsmen of a flock that's been enhanced by this famine. Interesting how that happens. Verses 16 and 17, they trade bread for livestock. It's the next logical step. Then in chapter 47 and verse 18, when that year had ended, so they have enough bread or grain for a year, they came to him the next year and said to him, we will not hide from my Lord that our money is gone. He says, we're going to be honest with you. We got nothing. We got no money. And now we got no livestock. But we still don't want to die from famine. We don't want to die of hunger. So we've got other things that we can trade and barter if that is befitting your solution. He says, my Lord also has our herds of livestock. There is nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. And that's kind of interesting because you assume that in a time like this, the government would possess the land and would lease it out to the people who would use it, but not that case. In fact, at this time in Egypt, the individuals were seeing a great amount of prosperity, which allowed them to purchase lands, which allowed them to own and possess lands for themselves instead of having to be, you would consider serfs back from, say, the Middle Ages, where a king owned all of the land and these people came in and agreed to work the land, receiving a portion and then getting a portion for themselves as well. But in Egypt, it wasn't like that. And so the Pharaoh and his power was diminished the worldwide nature of his power was diminished because he didn't possess the land itself. The people, in a lot of cases, possessed the land, as he mentions here. He says in verse 19, "Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed, that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate." So they come up with a solution. Notice it's not Joseph's solution, it's theirs. They say this is a reasonable way of handling this situation. We've got ourselves and we've got our land. How about we make an agreement here? We obviously can't sustain ourselves. We obviously can't provide for ourselves the grain that we need in order to survive. So how about we make an agreement? Right? It's not your fault and it's not our fault that we're in this situation, but we are in this situation. So let's move forward with it, they say. Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. That's a totally different situation than was before. Before, he merely taxed them for living in the area under his dominion. Now he owns the land. In fact, in verse 21, "And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end." And so what you have is a conglomeration of resources within the bounds of Egypt. That all of the resources that were out distributed amongst the people, and you can argue the economics of capitalism compared to communism or socialism, whatever the case is, what happened is that the famine in the land created an abundance of resources under Pharaoh's thumb, right? That allowed Pharaoh to take advantage of the situation, you might say. But ultimately what we're going to see is prosperity on all counts. So imagine if you're Pharaoh. Imagine if you're Pharaoh. Joseph doesn't come on the scenes. You spend 7 years of prosperity and everyone's doing really well and everything's going really well. And then 7 years of famine happen all of a sudden and you're expecting more years of a feast. And you are caught unawares. Now you don't know how long the famine is going to last. You don't know how to really deal with the famine. And then this young man named Joseph. Well, you could say relatively young. We don't know exactly how old he is when he becomes the second in the kingdom of Egypt. But to his credit, he is able to manage the resources of Pharaoh to the degree that not only is Pharaoh prospered. Obviously, he now has all the money in his house. He now has all the livestock and all the cattle and all the herds. And he now has all the land. He's got everything. I imagine Pharaoh is very pleased with his agreement with Joseph and putting him second in the kingdom of Egypt. But Joseph's frugality finds favor with the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh is very pleased about this. He is ecstatic in relation to the things that have been transpiring now. Though he's sad, it seems, over the wasteland that his nation is becoming. Notice we'll keep going, though, in verse 47 because it doesn't just end there. Joseph also shows fairness, and in his fairness finds favor with the famished, those individuals who are suffering through this difficulty. In verse 23, only the land, that's 22. Then Joseph said to the people, verse 23, "Indeed I have bought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own as seed for the field and for your food, for those of your household, and as food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives." Look at that. They have yielded their money, they have yielded their livestock, they have yielded themselves and their service and their land to Pharaoh. And how do they respond to Joseph? Not with pitchforks and burning torches. They are pleased with the agreement that Joseph has established with them. They are pleased for the situation has happened. Not necessarily that the famine in the land has caused them all this issue, but with the resolution of the problem. Because what happens otherwise? People go, "Well, why doesn't Pharaoh just give all of his goods away? Why doesn't he just give people grain and let everybody have grain and bread?" Because that only solves the problem. That only solves the symptom. It doesn't solve the problem. The problem is, right now, that the people of the land, and because of this famine in the land, because of this huge pestilence, because of this huge issue, the people of the land cannot raise their own resources enough to the degree that they can not only maintain their own grain and their own eating, they obviously can't even do that, But then they're eating their own grain. They're eating the grain and the seed that they should be putting in the ground so that next year they can have a harvest. So he goes out and St. Joseph just gives people bread. Okay, so they've got bread now. They can live another year. And at the end of that year, what happens? They've got no grain still. They're still in that horrible predicament, and they will the next year. Okay, so Pharaoh does it again. Now, I don't know how much grain storage he has, but unless someone is producing, Pharaoh's not going to have much to give the entirety of the land of Egypt. And so this solution comes to bear, and Joseph brings it forward. He says, hey, how about what we do is we have what's, you could call it a sharecropping, you could call it many things it's called. But ultimately what happens is they agree to work the land, and he provides the grain, and they work the land for Pharaoh. They don't work their own land, though they probably end up with their own land to work, but it's not their land anymore. And so they work that land, and they give a fifth to Pharaoh. A fifth of it goes back to Pharaoh. Now, Pharaoh supplied the land. Pharaoh supplied the grain in order to plant. And all he requires in this agreement is a fifth back. But we say, well, that's an exorbitant. No, it's not. In most cases, in fact, especially during the Middle Ages and even before, many of the kingdoms that took place, they expected at least a third, if not half, in most cases. They would give you barely, and you've probably read articles about even today, issues in these third world countries where people are trying to get out of the situation they're in, and people will take a resource that they can get a hold of, and they will sell it to an individual. For instance, straw for making baskets. This is the most often used illustration. And they'll take straw and they'll buy it for excessively cheap. Straw doesn't cost much, but they have the resource to go to a different area to get it, and they'll bring it back to an area where they can't find straw. They will sell it to usually a woman who's trying to make her own way in the world, a business, trying to feed her family, trying to supply for the needs of her family. Will sell it to her at exorbitant prices, but give her a loan in order for her to have it. And at the end, we'll take that and buy it back for almost nothing, barely enough for her to feed her own family, and then sell it for exorbitant prices and make money on both ends. So this person is held in a stasis of poverty while there is an individual who's taking advantage of the situation. Brethren, that's not what's going on here. Joseph is completely fair with these people. Joseph says, four-fifths stay with you in your household. Four-fifths are staying with you of the work that you supply. And we're providing the grain. And then you and your family can eat and be taken care of through your own labor. In verse 21 especially. Not 21. Oh, that's the problem. I'm in chapter 47. There we go. Maybe it is 21. He moved them into the cities. There we go. Verse 25. Notice how they respond. It's not how you would think. Hey, so they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servant." They say, "You have saved our lives." We are overjoyed at this agreement that we can come to. We are happy to be in this situation because you are treating us fairly. The weird thing is that Joseph doesn't have to treat them fairly. They're what you would call over a barrel. They're in a bad situation, and Joseph has all the cards. He's holding all the keys. He has all the power. And yet he is still overwhelmingly fair with these people. And the people love him for it. And because the people love him, the people love Pharaoh. And so Pharaoh benefits not only from the wisdom of Joseph in part one, his frugality in relation to the things of this life, but also in how he treats the people of the kingdom. And then in Genesis chapter 48, we see a number of things going on as far as Joseph's forgiveness and how it finds favor with his family. In verse 1 he says, "Now it came to pass after these things..." So he finally resolves the situation, notice that. Then he goes back to his family and he's starting to work out his family again. It says, Joseph was told, indeed your father is sick. And he took with him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And Jacob was told, look, your son Joseph is coming to you. And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. I love that. He hears that his family is coming, that Joseph, his, in that sense, favorite son, probably still, and his two sons, the two sons that were born in Egypt, are coming, Ephraim and Manasseh. And he strengthens himself. He gets ready for this day. It's going to be hard. It's going to be complicated. But he is strengthening himself. He is preparing himself, is a good word for that, in his bed. And he sits up. Then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. Remember, before he had moved around and done many of the things that he had done, come back to the land, God had promised him once again. Just as he had promised Abraham, promised Isaac, and then Jacob or Israel, he promises him as well. He says, and said to me, behold, verse 4, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you a multitude of people and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. Verse 5, and now your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Whoa! We're like, I take his grandkids to him, you know, so he can see him before he dies, and the dude's like, those are my kids now. What are you talking about? He says, they are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. So he gives you an illustration. He doesn't mean this in a metaphoric quality. He says, they're going to be my children in the same way that Reuben and Simeon are my children. If you look at the land, a map of the land of Israel, you see two names that stick out. They don't really make sense why they're there. But you got Reuben, and you've got Simeon, and you've got Gad and Asher, and you've even got Benjamin in there with Judah. And you say, well, who is this Ephraim and Manasseh characters? They're Joseph's two sons. That Israel, Jacob, he says, they're mine now. They're not yours anymore. In fact, he would make mention, verse 6, your offspring who you beget after them shall be yours. See, I'll bless you here. You can have the rest of your kids. Like, I don't want the rest of that litter. I just want these two in particular. But there's a reason he's doing this. Notice he says, they shall be called by the name of their brothers and their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan in the way, when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, who are these? And Joseph introduced him to his two grandsons. And we're going to move down real quick to verse 15. He says, so he's stretching out his hand, verse 14, over the two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh. And this is what he says, verse 15. And he blessed Joseph. Wait a second, he's got his hands over Ephraim and Manasseh, but he's blessing Joseph. He says, God before whom my father Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. Lest my name be named upon them, and the name of my father Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And in fact, he would go on to talk about the younger, which is the interesting thing, is Ephraim. The older is Manasseh. And he blesses them backwards. And Joseph is even like, hey, you got this backwards. Right? He puts his right hand on Ephraim and his left hand on Manasseh, being the superior and the inferior. It's backwards. This is my right hand, though, just so you know. Which is interesting. And Joseph is like, hey, hang on. And Israel says, no, I know what I'm doing. Get back, right? He said, get back away from me. So verse 21, he says, then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given to you, notice this, I have given to you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. I have given you one portion above. What in the world? Remember, the oldest or the favored child, the one who received the blessing, just like, remember, Jacob received instead of Esau through trickery, to be fair. Right? Isaac received instead of Ishmael because he was the promised son. So Joseph receives a double portion, but it's in the nature of his two sons that end up receiving it. Though back in verse 15, he mentions specifically that he blessed Joseph while he has his hands on the sons. Notice also, he makes mention there between the two passages, verses 16 and on, concerning Ephraim would be greater than his brother Manasseh, even though Ephraim is younger. Now, if you remember your history back in the days of Isaiah, the divided kingdoms that take place because Rehoboam doesn't follow the wisdom of the people who know what's going on, and he persecutes the people even more so than his dad did. And there is a division of the kingdoms. The northern 10 tribes go away and they follow a man named Jeroboam, and the southern 2 tribes stay with Rehoboam, and it becomes the northern 10 tribes and the southern 2. The northern 10 tribes are usually called Israel, though later on they become known as Ephraim because of the major tribe in the area is Ephraim. Even over Manasseh, even over Gad, even over Asher, even over the brothers, Ephraim becomes the title for that area because of their prosperity, because of their prominence in the area. And so they become a leader of the people for a time, very much like Judah does in the early stages of the United Kingdom, just like they were supposed to. Although kings make bad decisions, it happens, I suppose. And so this forgiveness, remember this forgiveness that took place back a few chapters ago when Joseph didn't destroy his brothers, though he could have. Yeah, he didn't persecute them and cause problems with them. In fact, he completely forgave them of the wrongs that they had done to him. And notice the favor that he receives because of it. If we turn over a couple of chapters to chapter 50, the very end of the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 50, in verse 15, he says, "Then Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead." Sad day for the family. So their father is dead, and they have an agreement, and that takes place earlier. Jacob dies there at the end of chapter 49 after he blesses each of the sons, including Ephraim and Manasseh. And then they take him, as was agreed, back to the land of Israel, the land of the promise. And they bury him there with his father and his grandfather, Abraham. And so he dies, and they said to themselves, it seems, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us, and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him." And not because he was remorseful for the hatefulness that he had in his heart and his dad's message really struck home with him. No, because he'd already forgiven them. They're like, "Oh, our dad is dead, and that might be the only thing that held Joseph back from destroying us to begin with. Maybe now that dad's dead, he's going to start taking vengeance on us, and he's going to use the power that he has to hurt us. We don't want that, so we're going to either contrive..." It doesn't say whether this letter or this message was really from their dad. But imagine the hurt that you have when people that you've forgiven and people that you've pursued their good in this nation, in the nation of Egypt, and you provided for their families and their homes, and you've done all these great things for them because you love them. And now they're worried that you're going to kill them. And that you're going to torture them and be merciless with them all of a sudden. And Joseph's sad. And he says it couldn't be further from the case. "Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face. And they said, 'Behold, we are your servants.' Joseph said to them," look what he says, "'Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God?'" He says, "Do I have the authority like God does to..." In that sense, like the king in Second Kings, when Naaman sends word to the king of Israel, "Hey, I'm coming. Please get the holy man ready because I have leprosy and I want this dealt with." And he says, "Am I God to give life or take it?" And Joseph says, "I'm not God. I'm not going to take vengeance on you guys," which is also in a way to say God might. But Joseph says, "I'm not going to." How many times has Joseph already said, "We're good. Quit worrying about it. He said that from the very beginning. He said, stop worrying that you did these things. I know you did these things. You know you did these. God knows you did these things. It's done. It's over. He says, but as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. I can't say that enough times. Just the attitude that Joseph has, the forgiveness that he can acquire because he understands his relationship with God. In order to bring it about, as to this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. How many times am I going to say that to you? Do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones. And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. This Joseph guy, he's got something. There's something to him. And when Joseph dies, he has his family promise that they will take his body when they leave. When they leave Egypt, that they will take his body with them. And he is embalmed. They embalmed him, verse 26, and he was put in the coffin in Egypt. And if you follow back into Exodus, guess what they leave with? They don't forget. They don't forget because he was forgiving of the faults of his family. And he finds favor with that family because of it. So he's found favor now with Pharaoh, with the famished people of Egypt, with his own family. And why is that? This is the crux of the situation here. In Luke chapter 16, we read a really interesting parable that Jesus teaches. In Luke chapter 16... it is problematic to a lot of people because they just refuse to see what Jesus is saying. In Luke chapter 16, starting in verse 1, and he said to his disciples, There was a certain rich man who had a steward, and an accusation was brought to him that his man was wasting his goods. You would not consider this man frugal. And the concept of wasting isn't necessarily stealing, but he's not maximizing the potential of the goods to which he had been delivered. You would say, well, you would go right to Matthew 23 and 24. Actually, it's 25, isn't it? The parable of the talents. That last individual who's given only one talent, he wasted that talent, not because he threw it out, not because he lost it, but because he refused to use it to its ultimate potential. And this servant, this steward, is called into question because of it. So he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my master is taking the stewardship away from me. I cannot dig. I am ashamed to beg. Now this pretty much just puts the nail in the coffin. He pretty much admits, not necessarily to his own master, but he essentially admits, when these books come in, it's not going to be favorable for me. And these things aren't going to go well for me. So he resolves in himself, he says, what to do. That when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So he called every one of his master's debtors to him and said to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. So he said to him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Then he said to another, and how much do you owe? So he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. So he stopped there in verse 8. For just a second, and we have to get an idea of the situation. So this steward is in charge of the resources that this master has, and he has debtors, this master does. He has people in his books who owe him grain, who owe him wheat, who owe him oil. Now, so this guy doesn't have to dig or have to beg, he comes up with a solution, a shrewd, and don't miss the fact that he mentions here, Jesus himself, an unjust solution. He calls a spade a spade. He doesn't run around the bush, beat around the bush or anything. But this guy takes the record book and he takes the certificate that these individuals would have and he changes the numbers on them. Now he doesn't take, not once does it say that he took any kind of payment for the debt that was owed. He merely created favor with another. He used his resources in an unjust way to create favor with another individual so that he could not have to work when he got let go of this guy's, or he'd have work that wasn't begging or digging, which would be the most remedial of work, the work that he didn't want to do, so that he didn't have to do that when he was done with his master. He's creating favor with others. Now, notice again, I'm going to mention it a third time, he is unjust. Jesus is not saying, hey, do this, it's really awesome. No, he is recognizing that even in an unjust world, even with people who don't understand religion and spirituality and the importance of the usefulness of wealth to the ultimate glorification of God, folks still know how to work the system. They are, he uses the word shrewd. You could use the word frugal. Now remember, he is being unjust, and Jesus is not saying it's okay to be unjust. What he's doing is he's looking at a world that is unjust, and he's looking at a person that is doing unjust things, and he appreciates only that this person is willing to do whatever it takes to make it work. Right? And that's the problem a lot of people have. Have you ever watched a show about criminals, for instance? And just the resourcefulness that some people have. And sometimes I just say, well, that was really resourceful of him. I'm not saying it was good that he robbed a bank. I'm merely saying it was impressive that he was so resourceful with what he had. That's it. And that's what Jesus is saying. In fact, to such a degree that in verse 9, he says, and I say to you, make friends for yourselves by unrighteous mammon, that when you fall or fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. And that's an interesting verse we'll get to in just a second. He who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. Therefore, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for he will either hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And there's the ultimate culmination of the point he's making. He's saying the world knows how to use the resources they have to be frugal in that sense, even in unrighteous ways. A righteous person has no reason not to learn how to be frugal with the resources God has provided them in righteous ways. What does that mean? Faithfulness in the small things. And in a spiritual context, that would be the earthly things. So we talk about, usually we get this wrong, but the smallest thing in the world, the smallest thing is money. Money ultimately cannot buy you into heaven, right? But you can do things with money that glorify God. Your time, your talents, and you would use all these things and talk about all these things. But what is happening here, Jesus is saying, if the world, in their evilness, and in evil ways, and he doesn't back off of that, he says they're evil in that thing, and you shouldn't do the things they do, but recognize the resourcefulness and their willingness to do whatever they can to make things work. And then you apply that to Christians, who just, and in some cases is absolutely the case, just expect God to do everything for them. And yet when Jesus sent the apostles out, the 70, remember what he told them? Be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. He said you should not be enamored in the evilness of the world and the things that they're involved in. Keep yourself separated from that. But you got to be wise when you're going out there. You got to know what you're doing. You've got to be faithful in these small things. In Matthew chapter 23, this is really kind of an illustration of what he's saying here. He says, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, verse 23. One of the many woes that come down upon the scribes and Pharisees. He says, woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. We must be obedient in all things. That's Jesus' point. And a lot of the time, in the small things, and what the things we consider small, and if we're anything like the Pharisees, and sometimes we are, to be fair, we got them in the wrong position, right? We got the small things over here, which are really the big things, and we got the big things over here, which are, in Jesus' mind, the small things. These Pharisees, they were tithing of anise and mint and cumin. They were doing the things that they considered important. They considered those the big things. And Jesus says, those are the small things. Justice, mercy, those are the big things. Those are the things you should have been doing. But notice he doesn't say, and you could have neglected tithing of anise and mint and cumin. He doesn't say you should have neglected the smaller things of the law. He says you need to keep the law. You need to keep the whole law. Whether it's a big thing or it's a small thing. If it's part of the law, it is something to be obeyed. And that application in the Old Testament transitions right into the New. Not that we obeyed the law in the Mosaic Covenant, but the law of Christ must be obeyed. And we as Christians, and as sometimes to our own detriment, we determine what is small and what is big. And we yell at the world sometimes when they say, well, baptism is a small thing. It's not a big deal that you don't get baptized. And we point to the Scriptures and we say, that is certainly not the case. Baptism is not a small thing in that context. It's a part of the plan of salvation. You say just as much as repentance is a part. And they say, well, I agree that repentance is a big thing. And we say, oh, well, money is a small thing. But not when it comes to 2 Corinthians chapter 9. It comes to us giving as we purpose in our hearts, not begrudgingly or of necessity. God loves a cheerful giver. That means that giving is a big thing to God, though we make it a small thing. There are a lot of big things, and there aren't a lot of small things. Joseph, in fact, was concerned with things whether they were big or small. He said, these little peon people, these little guys at the bottom, I just roll over them. Who cares what they want? Who cares what they need? Who cares how their life works? Joseph said, no. He said, I'm going to take care of the Pharaoh, and I'm going to take care of the people, and I'm going to take care of my family. I'm going to do everything that I can because I am that person. I am God's person here, he says, in Egypt. And the same goes for us. We can neglect what we consider the smaller matters of the law of Christ. If it's the law of Christ, it demands attention. And more importantly, it demands obedience. And that's what Jesus is saying there in Luke chapter 16. Say, if the world in its evilness can use its own resources to further its own agenda, the child of God should be able to use their resources, the resources in all honesty that have been given them, bless them by the Almighty, to further the gospel of Jesus Christ, the glorification of God. We should be able to do that. Whatever means are not outside of our bounds, as far as our spirituality, our relationship with God, we should be willing to address those situations, to change in the situations that need to be changed. And we get so static and so stagnant in the way things have always been done. Well, Joseph wasn't a guy who followed the way things have always been done. Now, he followed God, and he followed the law of God as far as was given to him, the directives, and the law of the land that he was under with Pharaoh. But he found new ways to do the things that needed to be done. He wasn't constrained. He used the wisdom, the frugality, the fairness, and the forgiveness that he had been given by God to make the most of the resources that he possessed. And brethren, I ask, are we doing that? Are we making the most of the life, the opportunities, and the challenges, James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, that God gives us to grow in patience, to grow in glorification of God, to grow the kingdom, to be the child of God that we need to be? Because if we're not, then we're not really being like Joseph. Because Joseph used every opportunity. Joseph tried to take advantage of every opportunity he found to be more, in that context, his life anyway, to be more like God. We need to be like Joseph. And we need to obey in even the small things, the things we consider small. That you could argue there really aren't any small things. So are we obedient to God? And that's really the question tonight. Where's the authority? Is God the authority? Is God the one who's going to decide what is important and what you're going to do? Or are you? And if you want to respond to the Lord's invitation today to become a child of God, to take those steps, and I'll tell you right now, they are big steps. Not because they are more important than anything else that the Bible talks about, but because they require a level of obedience They require a commitment of our lives. Jesus himself says that we have to count the cost, which means there's a cost that we have to be willing to pay to become a child of God. And if you're willing to pay it tonight and you would like to do so, you can become a child of God tonight. You can be washed and redeemed in the blood of Jesus Christ. And if you want to come back, pay the price of returning, that is, full commitment to Christ. And you want to come back with that full commitment to Christ, you can do so tonight. We can help you. And if you are struggling in sin, iniquity in this world, struggling with your life, struggling with pain and sorrow, whatever the case, brethren, we are here for you to help you through these difficulties, help you become the person God has called you to be. If we can help, I pray that you would come while we stand and sing.